Thank you for downloading this edition of A Point of View, America Votes. Here's Roger Scruton.
Travelling in the American heartland at the beginning of this week, I was struck by a peculiar fact. Nowhere did I catch sight of a poster or placard exhorting people to vote Hillary or vote Trump. Behind every porch, there was a householder preparing to vote for one or the other. But the porches, which have in past elections been plastered with proud declarations of commitment, were empty. This reticence lasted through the day of the election itself. It has been customary for the returning officers to provide each voter leaving the electoral station with a sticker saying, "I voted for X or Y," giving the name of the chosen candidate. These stickers would be proudly and cheerfully displayed for the rest of the day. This time, the stickers were still given out, but they said only, "I voted." In this and many other ways, the nation revealed its shared sense of shame. The attitude was, "We have to make a choice, but we wish it were not this one." And surely neither candidate would have stood a chance against a rival who was genuinely worthy to be president. That said, we still need to explain a result that few people predicted and which the media and the opinion polls dismissed as a remote possibility. As in our own parliamentary election and the referendum over Brexit, the opinion polls were wide of the mark. And the explanation of this touches on the real meaning of the result. In America, as in Britain, the indigenous working class has been put out of mind, even overtly disparaged by the media and the political class. All attempts to give voice to their anxieties over immigration, over the impact on their lives of globalization and the spread of liberal conceptions of sex, marriage and the family, have been dismissed or silenced. Indeed, these people who have been cut adrift from an old form of life, but not provided with a new one, have been castigated with gross and ill-considered abuse. For the liberal elite, the disinherited working classes are racist, sexist, xenophobic, homophobic, Islamophobic. And while uttering these insults, opinion formers revel in the fact that they do not have to live where these people live, and that they can build around themselves a society of emancipated, tolerant, and progressively minded companions who would not dream of descending to the level of such narrow-minded bigots. It is for this reason that many who intended to vote for Trump would not have confessed to their intention. Charges like racist are intimidating. They imply that your feelings are not just erroneous, but wicked. They brand you as an outcast, a reject with no place in the nation's future. So you shut up and conceal your feelings. But your feelings are real all the same. And when the opportunity comes to express them with your vote rather than your tongue, you do so. I'm not talking of the silent majority. I'm talking of a despised minority, wrongly despised, but despised all the same, and reacting to contempt as all people do by hiding from it. That explains why the polls will always underestimate the numbers of these people, whose identity has been disrupted by the global changes, who have no means to adapt to them, and who therefore vote in order to cling to an old and threatened way of life. And two factors greatly inflamed the feelings of these people in the weeks prior to the American election. First, in a speech, Hillary Clinton repeated the charge of racism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, and you name it, dismissing Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables. She thereby confirmed their view that well-heeled liberals have no real interest in the fate of those who pay the cost of liberal policies. Moreover, seeing themselves insulted in this way did something to endear Trump to working-class voters, since the very same insults were also heaped on him. And then, in an ill-judged departure from convention, President Obama weighed in on Hillary Clinton's behalf with an all-out assault on Trump, underlining his defects of character and unfitness for office. Right though he was, Obama merely reinforced the feeling among the deplorables that a vote for Hillary was a vote for more of the same, whereas they wanted change, a change in the whole agenda of government. Now Trump is promising change, and in his elephantine stumbling through the political landscape, he has hit on one or two changes that are dear to the indigenous working class. Hence his triumph, and hence the great problem that the world as a whole, and America in particular, must now confront. Seldom, if ever, has a head of state been voted into office with his reputation so much in shreds, and his character so thoroughly despised, not merely at home, but also around the world. Trump has power now, but little or no authority, and certainly none of the charismatic authority that enabled Obama to turn the focus of American political culture away from capitalist enterprise towards the socialist welfare state. It is too early to say whether Trump will provide himself with wise advisers, but it is already clear that he is making the mistake that David Cameron made, namely the mistake of surrounding himself with advisers who agree with him. The real adviser is the one who disagrees and who gives you valid reasons for doing so. All this is of great importance to us. Trump's policy pronouncements are by no means consistent, but about one thing he seems certain, which is that America must curtail its global commitments, direct its attention not outwards to the world, but inwards to its vital interests, and cease to spend its resources on ungrateful nations that cannot be bothered to look after themselves. Americans now resonate to this message. They have had enough of the Islamist madness and would rather devote the nation's resources to ensuring that the madness does not come to America than risk the lives of their young men and women in the place where it begins. They do not understand why the European Union exists if it does not provide for its own defense. And insofar as the global economy means opening the country to competition that undercuts American wages, many Americans have had enough of it. Meanwhile, President Putin has assembled on his western borders forces sufficient to overrun Poland, Romania, Slovakia, Sweden, and the Baltic states in a space of days. Thanks to the European Union's freedom of movement provisions, most of those countries have lost a great deal of their young, who have fled westwards, leaving behind them one of the greatest demographic crises in the history of modern Europe. None of the countries on Russia's western border could now raise a conventional army capable of repelling an organized invasion. Only one thing stands between them and Russian dictatorship, and that is NATO, which commits American troops and strategic weapons to the defense of every member of the alliance. Trump would like to undo that alliance. America, he believes, has been providing a free ride to countries that have taken a cavalier attitude to their own defense and exploited the American taxpayer. And he sees no advantage in this to America. Moreover, withdrawing from NATO differs from most of Trump's policy suggestions to date in that it can be done without provoking an immediate social and economic crisis. No wonder Mr. Putin has received the news of Donald Trump's election with such unconcealed joy. We must hope that Trump can be persuaded to see things differently. Maybe he will understand that America has a vital interest in the continuing defense of Europe. Everything will depend on those advisers, not only on whether he listens to them, and listening does not seem to be high on the list of his qualities, but also on whether they will have the guts to stand up to him when he is wrong. The great merit of the American system is contained in the famous checks and balances of the Constitution, the procedures that prevent the emergence of monopoly powers in any of the branches of government. 3.5 centuries ago, Spinoza argued that a virtuous government is not a government exercised by virtuous people, but a government that remains virtuous even when exercised by villains. I cling to my belief that Spinoza's observation, intended as a rebuke to the Calvinist authorities of Holland, remains true of the United States of America, and that America will continue to be on the side of civilization, even with a president who doesn't yet know what civilization means.
A Point of View, America Votes, was written and presented by Roger Scruton.